There are coaches out there who literally are like, you've burnt 1200 calories in this 3 hour bike. This is what you need to replace. And then I have these athletes come to me and they're like, I am gaining weight.
Welcome to the Athlete's Compass podcast. Each week, renowned sports scientist and founder of Athletica AI, Dr. Paul Larson, athlete, coach, and sports scientist Mariana Rakai, and coach and cyclist Paul Warlowski discuss training, racing, and improving your health and fitness. Get ready for your journey to peak performance. Hello and welcome to the Athlete's Compass podcast, where we navigate training, fitness, and health for everyday athletes. Today, we're welcoming back Dr. Mickey Willadin to discuss a controversial theory turning the fitness world upside down. It suggests that no matter how much you exercise, whether you're a couch potato or an elite marathoner, your body burns roughly the same number of calories each day. Dr. Herman Ponsard's research in his book, Burn, is sparking this heated debate about everything we thought we knew about metabolism. We're not sure. Today, we're diving deep into this constrained energy model and what it is and why it matters for everyday endurance athletes. So, Mickey, for listeners who haven't heard of this, can you just describe the constrained energy model and why it's causing such controversy in the fitness world?
Yeah. Hey, everyone. Hey, Paul, and Mariana. Great to be back. And I will just qualify. I'm a nutritionist. I'm not a physiologist. So I'm looking forward to this conversation as much as you guys are, as in the trenches working with people and just my understanding of it. So I guess the constrained energy model suggests that total daily energy expenditure, it sort of sits within a band. Right. So it does rise with activity initially, particularly, but it can and does appear to plateau out amongst various populations, of which, of course, we can sort of chat about. So the body compensates for the high activity that it undergoes by reducing energy spent elsewhere on what I guess we could determine sort of non-essential processes like immune activity, reproductive hormones, stress responses, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, or NEAT. And I guess this, and of course, this would contradict that long-held assumption that the more activity you do, the more energy you expend. And I guess in some ways, if we're thinking about weight loss, which isn't necessarily the focus, but it's something that as athletes we are, you know, interested in from a body composition performance perspective, it might challenge that idea that more exercise you do, the more calories you burn, and therefore the more fat you lose. And with regards to, I guess, where that plateau sits, looking at the likes of Ponce's research on Howard's research that came out earlier this year, I think Bass and colleagues literally just released a paper last week looking at this, sort of the upper average bound was about 2.5 times basal metabolic rate. It doesn't mean that you won't and can't burn calories over and above this, you know, in more sort of isolated activities. Let's say, for example, Paul, you go out and run like 4 hours and usually you just run, you know, 2 hours. Like, of course, you're going to get an uptick in calories burned if that's the case. But as I understand it, on balance, there is that upper limit of 2.5 times BMR. I will add one thing, however, I did see an X exchange that included Killian Jornet and you know, his Western States effort, and I think he burnt something like 16,000 calories during that. So, I mean, so obviously there are exceptions, but that's my understanding. What do you guys think?
I had a question during, so maybe just a clarification for listeners. What is, if you're saying 2.5 times BMR, what is BMR for us listening first and foremost? What are we talking about in terms of numbers?
Yeah, nice one. So it's essentially the amount of energy required for your body literally just to exist, to blink, to breathe, for that physiological process, for everything that's sort of occurring in the body, that's your basal metabolic rate. And that makes up on for the average person, maybe about 70% of overall energy expended in a day. Although I do not think that that's the actual number for endurance-based athletes. That would be probably like a smaller portion of overall energy expended because we spend a lot of time training, right? But basal metabolic rate is the pretty much the bulk of energy expenditure for most people.
Well, if I'm sitting on the couch all day, what's a general number, you know, with a standard deviation kind of number on there? Like, what are we talking? Like 1,000 to 1,500 kcals, or like, what are we talking?
It's really dependent. Yeah, dependent, Paul, on age and sex and body weight and muscle mass, you know, all of those things. So it's really, I can't give a definitive number as a blanket, to be honest. Like, you see numbers sort of, you see numbers bandied about, like for a male, it'll be 2,500. For a female, it'll be, you know, 1,500 to 2,000. But you need to sort of, to accurately sort of assess that, you'd need to go into a laboratory and sort of spend time maybe in a metabolic ward or with a metabolic cart on, or, you know, there are varying ways of measuring that sort of with varying degrees of accuracy. Of course, you can go online and do a calculation, but
yeah. But you've given us a starting point, right? Okay. So it's going to matter to like the size of the individual and the amount of muscle and fat that they have on them. All that requires energy, and all of the inner workings of the body, we got to just actually live first and foremost. And then it's everything else above and beyond that. And of course, the old model that you kind of just mentioned is the calories in versus calories out kind of model, right? Is like, that's sort of what we're talking about here. And is that true? Is that the best way that we should be thinking about this? And isn't that a little bit about how this constrained energy model is talking about? What's the big issue with the constrained energy model, first and foremost?
With the big issue with the constrained energy model?
Well, or any of the energy in versus energy out model, and how does the constrained energy model kind of come into that? Like, what is it challenging ultimately?
I think isn't it challenging that like the limits of how much energy we can expend, like literally, like the idea that there's this, you know, the longer we go, or the more we do, the more calories we'll expend, and that it's this fixed linear sort of equation that we can predict. And I do think about this sort of outside of that model as well. And I think about just as athletes, you know, like, so for example, you'll be on your, like your wind trainer, you'll have your power output, your Garmin will be telling you that you're burning X number of calories for this particular session. And I often sort of think, well, I mean, how the experience of the athlete, how efficient you are, I think all of this plays into how much energy can, like, how well does this do at actually predicting energy output? You know, like, we've all here, like, sitting in this little room, like, we're all midlife, you know, we've been doing literally for decades. And to compare the amount of energy we might put out, like, there are two sort of ways of thinking about it, and this might be a slight tangent, but, you know, a novice coming in and doing the same session as us, they may well expend way more energy because they're just not as efficient. Their body just is not adapted to that type of output. Their, you know, mechanics aren't as used to it. So they'll likely put out a lot more energy as I understand it. So I think the calculations associated with those energy expenditure models can be problematic.
Yeah, to say the least, honestly. Like, we're talking, like, how do you really know any of these sorts of things? We're talking, let's talk internal versus external load first and foremost, right? We're talking like an external load marker, and like the best one that we would potentially have might be the cycling power meter, right? That's the best sort of closed system one, where we can get pretty solid markers of power output, and then from that you can get, you know kilocalories of energy that are actually being produced around that. But again, we still don't know internally if that's correct or not, because we're not all walking around in bomb calorimeters. Right. So it's like, and it relates to efficiency, you know, like when we're talking calories, you're actually talking about like the burning of fuel, the chemical energy, right? The chemical energy burning, like its conversion of chemical energy to mechanical energy. And that we know that's an inefficient process, that where maybe 80% of that energy is going to heat, 20% of that energy maybe is going to the actual mechanical energy output. So there's, yeah. and there's a whole lot of assumptions that are coming in all along here. So we're having these Twitter wars that you kind of mentioned, but it's like, you're really arguing over a lot of noise around there. And I'm not sure how much signal is actually kind of coming through. So I'll just mention that.
I know. I totally agree, Paul. And it's interesting if I think about, you know, what this means for the athlete, right? Because, and I've sent you emails before, I'm sure. Hey, Paul, how did, like, do you ever look at the calories burned in your athletes and then get them to sort of replace those calories? Because there are coaches out there who literally are like, you've burnt 1200 calories in this 3-hour bike. This is what you need to replace. And then I have these athletes come to me and they're like, I am gaining weight. Like I am like, this is, you know, not only is my gut really having issues with my digestion because I cannot tolerate this high number of calories my coach is telling me to have, but I'm literally gaining body fat. Like it's just, it blows my mind that any coach would actually look at these numbers and calculate sort of, okay, this is what you need to be doing. If you're not doing it, then you're not doing it right.
Yeah, totally. We follow similar people. Like you follow like Ben Bickman, and he's like, he's great at myth busting some of this sort of stuff. And he's not really even in the sport world too much, but he's in the overall caloric world. But he's just like, he's debunked much of this and just, he's great at reminding us of all of these nuances that are kind of coming through here, and that the energy in versus energy out model for calories is like, it's pretty delicate and ready to fall, but that doesn't mean that there's not some practical measures that kind of come back. And like on the other end of this too, right? We know we talked last time on REDS, right? So this is restricted energy.
Relative energy deficiency in sport.
Energy deficiency, right? And like, that's not a good thing too, right? Like if you're always deprived of energy and you feel that, well, that is going to have kind of issues around driving some of these other really important physiological processes going on in the body. Reproductive hormones is just one of them. Again, going back to the REDS, we're talking about the tell ultimately in terms of the health of the body for females, of course, the appearance of a regular menstrual cycle. In males, it might be the appearance of an erection in the morning for testosterone, because this is the HPA axis signaling to the HP gonadal axis that there's an issue in the body and you are low in energy, kind of thing. So there's I'm flipping all over the place there, Mickey, but you gave me permission. You said it's a discussion, and I should probably also let MJ chime in here too. I'm sure she's got some things to say. And Paul,
I'm going to reel it back. So the constrained energy model, the way I understand it, is that Dr. Ponce's research with the group of hunter gatherers showed that their energy expenditure is similar to Westerners, and that there's a cap of what we can burn. Well, clearly we have elite athletes throughout the years that have reported insane amounts of energy intake, like Michael Phelps or Christian Plumenfeld. And we have these, you know, outlier superhumans that can just intake and burn out like crazy amounts of energy. But I guess the key pillars are that exercise calories don't simply stack up on top of what, like a basal metabolic rate or whatnot. And then where this becomes problematic is the REDS, like what Prof just said.
Yeah, that's totally as I understand it as well, MJ. And it's, you know, and Ponce describes it as that the difference and all the reason why they're so similar is because of that reduction in that immune response, in the reduction of the reproductive hormones and in other physiology, a reduction in inflammation, like all of these processes which are sort of non-essential for that sort of immediate survival. So, but to your point, like I do think, and I was reading somewhere else that, you know, Ponce also says, you know, potentially limit of that sort of calorie burn or endurance really comes down to the ability to actually absorb and digest nutrients, which I'm sure we all know, like to your point about Michael Phelps and Christian Blumenthal, they are outliers, right? Like they, you know, they've just got this ability to consume like vast quantities of calories. And that's almost like last man standing, who can actually consume enough to really sort of push the boundaries. And I, you know, I wonder about that too, albeit then the likes of Killian, who actually for the amount of, you know, potential output that he puts out, he's not actually eating a lot of calories. It's not like he's consuming 16,000 calories during his event. You know, he's getting away with far less. So, you know, it's super interesting.
It is super interesting, super individual, I think, as well. I was on a call with one of those individuals that you mentioned. He ate the whole time. He was... We're on the call for at least an hour and he ate the whole time.
Wow.
Yeah. It was just like, yeah, it's like, you finish what's in your mouth. Yeah. No. Yeah. He was definitely maximizing his GI system. That's amazing. So yeah, it's great. I would never even, like, I would not even believe that was kind of the case unless I actually saw it myself. And I saw it.
Yeah. Yeah. And isn't that just what sets those guys apart from the rest of us middle-aged age groupers, you know? And I will say, oh my gosh, this is a tangent, but I'll say anyway, I struggle with the terms amateur versus professional, because when you've been in a sport for 30 plus years, like, that's not amateur, is it? Like, we're not amateur athletes. Similar with recreational versus professional. Like, we're not recreational either. That's why I like the term age grouper. Anyway, just a thought.
Yeah. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
But if, can we explain like the non-essential thing? Like, one thing that popped into my head as a mom was that when you're pregnant or breastfeeding, the priority goes always, like, energy goes to the baby or the fetus, right?
Yeah.
So if you're not getting enough energy as a mom, baby might be fine when you're pregnant, but you might struggle with health issues. Or when you're breastfeeding, the breast milk gets, the supply gets lower if you're not getting enough energy, right? So some of these examples that came to my head.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is that what's required for survival, isn't it? Like, and it does make sense from a survival of the species. Like, if we always had to have sufficient calories to support activity across the you know, human history, well, we probably wouldn't be here, because there've been, you know, like, from an evolutionary perspective, there've been times of famine, times of feast, like, so the body has these sort of inbuilt mechanisms to be able to survive periods of time where energy output was higher by reducing down these physiological processes. It just sort of makes sense, I think. And to your point, Mariana, like, during pregnancy, like, a lot of the mother's stores are absolutely shifted towards growing a baby human. And then this is why post-pregnancy, a lot of women can struggle, because what we think of as sort of postnatal depression might in fact be postnatal depletion of all of those micronutrients in addition to other stores, which of course is a complete, again, another conversation, but it's to your point, a really good example of that.
So the energy availability seems to be kind of that a key concept in this whole discussion.
Yeah.
How would you explain that to an athlete, and why is it more important than just counting calories?
Oh, great stuff, Paul. So basically, energy availability, it measures the energy left for physiological function once sort of expenditure or training cost is sort of deducted, right? And if you look at the literature, there are values associated with sort of thresholds for where energy availability over a long sort of, you know, I'm thinking sort of chronic energy availability, like what these thresholds are before we start dipping into issues with energy deficiency or red S, as we were chatting about before. Those thresholds are set, set at around, I think it's less than 30 kcal per kilogram of fat-free mass for females, and down at 20 kcal per kg of fat-free mass for males. And this is just based on data that has been collected based on the intakes of the athletes, you know, who have been sort of researched, like what are they actually eating, and subsequent, you know, outcomes associated with that athletic population. But there's also been pushback on energy availability as well, right? And I'm mm-hmm. not sure if you're familiar. Like, is it Arita? Is it Jose Arita? Might be one of the sort of key authors. And I want to say it's Trent Stellingworth, but it might not be. So I apologize if that's incorrect, because it probably is. But essentially, how do we know what athletes are eating? Like, who accurately self-reports their intake? Anyone that works with any sort of human knows how just so inaccurate that process is. So it's not that energy availability as a concept isn't a real concept, but it's just, you know, once we start attaching numbers to it, that's when I think that's when it can sort of become problematic. But the concept itself is true. Like the fact that at some point, you know, the cost of training in addition to just living is more than the energy that is required. And so that will, at that point, it will reduce hormone production. It will impair recovery and adaptation from training. You'll have negative implications for our immune resilience. It'll downregulate thyroid and metabolic rate, and that process itself. Whenever you go into, eating less calories, maybe like then, you know, into this sort of low energy availability state, that's just a natural sort of metabolic adaptation anyway. But if we think about energy availability from an athlete, what's less important, I think, than the numbers is, you know, what is the cost of training? What is the cost of performance? What is the cost of recovery? Like, these are the metrics that we should be much more worried about than trying to necessarily attach numbers to it and sort of looking at biofeedback markers.
Yeah, I love that, Mickey, and especially the limitation part that you described. And it kind of goes back to when I was talking about the external load marker, where we're looking at some of our wearable devices and we're trying to capture an energy output amount from all of these, whether it's a Whoop, an Oura Ring, a Garmin device, an Apple Watch, whatever, right? Again, this is an external load marker, and you're mostly, I would imagine, and you're trying to kind of attach something to that. Pretty difficult, lots of errors. And now you're trying to do this also for the energy intake using your favorite app. I mean, what are you, this is kind of, again, this is, I think, coming back to Benjamin Bickham's argument on how accurate are you really sort of being here? But the other thing I wanted to mention as well, I do actually like the word energy availability, and my bias that I probably share a little bit with you, Mickey, is kind of around some of the philosophies around the LCHF kind of framework. Yeah. Like, if we can let's keep in mind the key regulatory hormone that we haven't mentioned yet here on the podcast, but insulin, it's just so important. And it's sort of if we have insulin being high, and of course, don't forget, insulin is mostly triggered by glucose availability or glucose amount that's kind of passing by the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas, and it raises that insulin level. And then if that insulin level is always high, well, you're really clamping, you're putting yourself in this storage anabolic phase, and you're not really allowing for any metabolites to be released, especially triglycerides from your stored adipocytes, right? So that in itself is almost dampening potentially your energy availability. Now, in the converse, where you all of a sudden get that insulin level relatively balanced and even a little bit lower, then all of a sudden it triggers that cascade to allow you to be free and open to leveraging some of the stored adipocytes, and energy all of a sudden kind of comes out. And in my experience, we've had Phil Maftone on the podcast as well. And, you know, a lot of that kind of comes down to that a healthy, unhealthy athlete kind of philosophy. And a lot of things are kickstarted. All the things that Mickey sort of mentioned, all the various different hormones and immune markers, that all kind of comes back in place. And also the, in the female situation, you know, a show of a regular menstrual cycle. MJ knows what I'm talking about. So, yeah, I know I'm just kind of spitballing around what you sort of led off with there, Mickey.
Yeah, and if I am allowed to use a personal anecdote, then, you know, this year I did two multi-day run races. So one, the Southern Lakes Ultra, it was 270 kilometers over 7 days. And then we went to, it was amazing. And then we went and did the Grand to Grand, which is the Grand Canyon to the Bryce Canyon in September. Wow. And it was phenomenal. And I really, like, just from I get goosebumps thinking about the experience, because I wasn't sure that I'd be able to do it. And part of it, but it was never actually related to the fueling, but I am mentioning it for the fueling aspect of it. But just the, you know, the mental ability to get up and run. And I'd never run longer than 80 kilometers. And in both events, I had to run 83 and 87 in a day, you know, it was all of this. But then from a fueling perspective, like, there are a significant portion of people who are really chugging down quite a lot of fuel and having significant gut issues because of the heat, because of the altitude, and really struggling in that respect. And because of the years that I've spent training in a lower carb state, we went out there because I did it with my hubster. We ran it together, and like, our carb intake was about, I'd say, 20 grams an hour, actually, for the Southern Lakes Ultra, 20 to 25. And then in the Grand to Grand, we just lifted it slightly to 35, I think, an hour. Like, if I had to do an average, totally fine. Energy was not an issue at all. And mm-hmm. I do think it comes down a lot to what you were talking about, Paul, with just that ability to be able to tap into our adipocytes and release triglycerides. And it wasn't that, and even though we were expending huge amounts of energy, like, we didn't drop weight really, like, and I didn't lose muscle, and there wasn't any of that telltale sign really of sort of overdoing it. So I think, so that's just in agreement with what you're saying, Paul, like, there's real value in being able to teach the body to burn energy. And it's not about fat loss, actually. It's about, you know, utilizing your metabolic machinery.
I think that there, like, what you're saying, Mickey, is that and Paul, there is, you always have to look at the history of the athlete. What are they used to feed themselves with? You said earlier, you said energy to perform versus energy to train. And then we're also talking about red S, so, which relates to the health, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're thinking about the constrained energy model and, like, assume that there's a cap of what we can burn, it doesn't make a lot of sense to rely on the inaccurate measures of energy output or energy intake and then try to hit, like, a daily energy intake based on what we're doing, but maybe shooting an estimate of overall energy over a longer period of time, right?
Mm.
Yeah, that's my question too. How do we individualize this? If we're not, you know, if Paul's saying that the calories in, calories out model is not necessarily the right model, if that's what I'm hearing correctly, and we have the constrained energy model, how do we square that circle? How do we know how much to eat?
take an Ironman day. Like, you're hungry for days after because you can't stuff so much food. Like, you can't replace all the, like, all your multi-day races. You cannot, like, stuff yourself so much. Maybe somebody who is working on, like, doing this every single day because they're a pro athlete, they can eat for an hour. But, like, I cannot feed myself enough. After an Ironman, you're not hungry, and then just, like, you just don't feel like eating. So you keep eating for several days. You just, like, add a little bit more over several days to replace what you spend on a one big day, right?
Yeah. And I think Paul W., your question is, I think there is a way to think about sort of what you eat in light of training, because I'm not standing here saying you don't need to eat more on a hard training day. You can be, you know, you're fine. Yeah, that is not what I'm saying. But I think what I'm saying more is because it does trend up, but there is a cap. But we cannot rely on the numbers that are associated with this to say, yes, I need to eat 463 more calories today because of this, and this is what I'm going to do. Like, so my advice for athletes in this is, you know, like to avoid the potential pitfalls of relative energy deficiency leading to impaired recovery and adaptation. Like, when you go, you know, if you're thinking about fat loss for an athlete, like, I never want an athlete to go into super low, you know, intakes when they're in key training phase. So thinking about cycling or like if body composition improvement is something they really want to dial in and focus on, then you do that in the off season when training load is lower. So overall stress is lower. You know, when we do have key training sessions, when you really do want to increase overall output, we're not attaching numbers to it, but you probably do need more food and fuel going in at that point to help with that recovery and adaptation. But it's sort of leaning into the biometrics and sort of assessing how you feel and sort of matching your input to that. Not in some sort of woo-woo, like, just not that you never think about numbers or anything, but you're not so tied into this the concept of X number of calories to support the training. Because to MJ's point, I mean, hard training really can suppress your appetite and make it difficult. You don't want to stuff yourself. You want to be smart about the type of fuel you're having, but it is really challenging to eat a truckload on some days. And it makes more sense to allow the appetite response to occur a couple, you know, which is pretty natural for most people, to listen to that in the couple of days afterwards.
Yeah. I don't know. That's awesome, Mickey. And that's kind of what I was going to go at too. So you mentioned appetite, the apostat. So, and the ability to listen to the body and, you know, I don't want to shoot myself in the foot with Athletica and whatnot, you know, because inevitably we are going to be merging some of this technology into Athletica. Right. And when I'm talking about our, you know, partners like Hexus and whatnot that have these, they're really working hard on these various different solutions to, you know, to, for all athletes, irrespective of your nutrition philosophy and whether you're taking a picture of your food that you're consuming and getting an estimate of the calories and the micros and macros that are kind of coming with that. That is all coming in this next year for sure. And I think you would use this in the same sort of way that you use Athletica. You can't, and we say this as well, like, you don't take the Athletica prescription for gospel, right? You've got to take it as a partner in your own, to help you kind of guide towards your own optimal and whatever that may be. And I think these texts that are kind of coming in here as well are going to be, I think you should do the same sort of thing. So develop your feel, what feels right. You are an N of one experiment. Keep tinkering and tweaking these sorts of things and find out what is optimal for you. Use these tools at your disposal to help guide you and run that N of one experiment. And it's an exciting time from that perspective, where more and more individuals are going to be, you know, have these sorts of tools accessible to them and can continue to get the help that maybe they've been looking for.
And do you know what, Paul? It's interesting with that because, of course, I think these tools are excellent, and the people who really love them, like the people who will buy into it, are naturally geared towards wanting those numbers. Like, you know, you'll always have someone that will be telling me how many calories I need to, you know, support this training session or to drop body fat or whatever. And they're really after that one particular number. And there will always be people like that. So it's sort of like, that's almost like the art and science of coaching, you know, of coaching, you know, sport as much as it is coaching people around nutrition. Like, it's to your point that N equals one, which can't be captured in the algorithms that are out there.
Yeah. So many know I was in an investor tour in Texas and ran into MJ, and our CEO Simon was moving us around to various different investors. I will tell you, every single investor that was an athlete, they asked about nutrition. Does it integrate nutrition? There's a huge desire that for that integration. I will just tell you, like, I know it's very, very clear. And, you know, I'm being a little hard and scrutinizing some of the methods here, I know, and I know we're going to improve on them. But yeah, like, it's, this is one that we, you know, my area and Mickey's area, we need to merge these and do a better job, because they are related and people want a solution in them.
And I do, and I think that scrutiny is going to be what sets you apart, Paul, actually, in the end, because too many people don't look deeper into or don't account for some of these things, because, I mean, they're so hard to account for. But if you could find a way to be able to merge them both in a way that actually has the outcomes that the athlete benefits from, then, I mean, that would be amazing.
I think these tools are really helpful in teaching athletes about nutrition, about training, and about listening to their bodies and what the body tells. And I think it's like part of the progress, really. Like, we have to start at one point, even if the technology is not there quite yet. But it's that, like, one step ahead. Like, you need to start somewhere if you want to get to
agree.
You know, yeah. Point B, but you have to start. So I think the scrutiny and critical thinking is great. But in the meantime, athletes can learn so much, but don't get into like their, you know, black and white box, like think holistically.
It's so good. And I reflect on Dan Plouze's PhD, right? Think of us back in when we started that in, like, you know, 2011, when HRV was really scrutinized. Oh, what are you doing, right? But, you know, you got to start somewhere, right? And you have to start taking some chances and whatnot. Credit to him and all the, you know, the supporting programs around at High Performance Sport New Zealand, Rowing New Zealand, et cetera, that supported that. And then, you know, carved a pioneer, you know, he's pioneered basically an industry now that, you know, is, again, technology that's embedded now within the back end of Athletica. But that wouldn't have started, or wouldn't be here now, if you didn't sort of take these chances, scrutinized it, and continued to refine, iterate, develop. And now we have something, and we'll do that with nutrition as well.
Yeah, 100%. And I will clarify, I love what you said, MJ, and I agree with you, is that, you know, something like, let's take counting calories as a good example of this. Like, it is such an inexact, inaccurate process. The benefit that people get from this, if they do it, and I've spent 25 years at this point as a coach, and only really spent about 3 to 4 years thinking about macros, if I'm honest. Like, I never had to do it, but I always thought in food and thought in appetite and thought in response. I never thought, oh, you need X number of calories. And it seemed to work for clearly the majority of people I worked with. But now, with the sort of influx of macro coaching and those weekend courses, everyone's demanding it. So I do spend a bit of my coaching in that area. And where I feel it's beneficial is that it does, to your point, MJ, teach people about food. Where do you find protein that you need? Where do you find the carbohydrates that you want? Where do you find the fiber that we're after, if we're after it? Where do we get those healthy fats from? You know, how do we distinguish this? So people can start becoming educated about what's in food, what makes them feel good post-training, during training, pre-training. But there are some people, and I have friends who've literally counted calories for decades, and they will until they die, seriously. But most people, they use it as a great way to get educated around food. And then you move from that to intuitive eating, which is a whole other conversation, but informed eating. So, you know, they know they can put together a plate. They don't have to count calories to know that it's got what they need to help support recovery and to help keep them satisfied, and that blood sugar is going to be stable. I do think that there's a real learning process in that, and it's actually quite valuable from that perspective, but not to try and balance that calorie counter at the end of every 24-hour period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do you... If individualization is individualized nutrition is still important, when the model, the constrained energy model, suggests that everybody's capped, and I put capped in quote marks, you know, at roughly 3,000 calories, what makes the biggest difference in real calorie needs?
So, I mean, obviously, I think like lean mass is one of the biggest sort of predictors of like calorie needs. And so the more muscle mass you have, like the more calories you need to fuel the machine everyday life. So I think that would be certainly one thing I think about. From a training perspective, yes, there's a cap, but it's hard to push beyond that cap. So it does still count if you're doing a lot of high intensity work. If you're doing a lot of long duration work, clearly the cost of that is going to be greater than easy 45 minute jogs on a down week. I do think that things like hormone status can shift substrate use. You know, like if you think about the luteal phase for a female, as I understand it, we are more insulin resistant during that phase. So that will change sort of fuel partitioning slightly, potentially. And also non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So, you know, how much activity are you executing on an everyday basis outside of that training session? I think these are all things to consider with sort of overall caloric requirements on any given sort of day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'll just say anecdotally, it's spot on. Just one observation. So many of us know about Luke Evans, who won Ironman Canada on Athletica, and then he went on again to win Ironman Arizona. This is a big man, and working with him on his nutrition as well was, that was one of the challenges. Like, he's just such a big unit and a bigger person. You got bigger caloric demands, right? And this guy is eating all the time. So just one of those many factors.
And I was, I have a friend / client who came to me with her nutrition, and she's tiny. She's tiny. She is like a little pocket rocket, very good runner. She's around my age, a little bit older, and her intake was so low, like 1,000 calories a day. Like too low, actually. And so, you know, we worked to just because she wasn't actually getting essential nutrients that she needed for the long term, not necessarily the here and now for training, because clearly she was doing very well. She wasn't injured. But in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't think you've got the substrates we need to help keep your bones healthy and to help keep your muscle mass on your body for the longer term. So, her frame, like her, she was basically eating at what her potential basal metabolic rate sort of was, and eating very little in that. So it's almost the opposite of what you were saying, Paul, but because she was so little, her overall caloric requirements would have been far less than if she was 10 kilos heavier. Like that would have been a lot more to sort of support, but it is so individual.
Great contrast.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have time to talk more about the perimenopausal changes and energy intake, protein, and focusing on strength work.
We're going to now.
Yes, let's go.
Let's bring it up.
How, as a perimenopausal woman who is active, how do you protect your bone? Like, is it caloric intake? Is it protein? Tell us, everybody wants to know.
So certainly those two things I do think matter. I think the timing of nutrients matters as well, MJ. Like, we don't have a lot of good research on it, but that energy availability concept isn't just sort of an overall concept for sort of in general, but, you know, there are studies to show that bone markers, that you get an acceleration of bone turnover without the rebuild, the bone breakdown without the rebuilding, if you go for a long period of time without eating post-training. So I think that there is something to be said for nutrient timing and getting in fuel post-training, albeit there haven't been a lot of studies and it is short-term data. We don't know the long-term implications of that, but that is definitely a thing that I think about. I do think, you know, in perimenopause, not just I think, but we know that women don't tolerate carbohydrate as well because estrogen is either really high and creating inflammation, or it's on its way out. Well, it is on its way out, but it is low, and therefore we're losing that insulin sensitizing impact of estrogen. So lowering sort of carbohydrate intake, focusing primarily on quality carbohydrate that maybe better from blood sugar stabilization perspective, but still getting in what you need to help support the nervous system. So moving away from processed refined carbohydrate, I think is usually a good move. Look, I definitely have some element of that, you know, and it's not like I never have anything like that, but we've just got to focus much more on quality and micronutrients. To your point, protein, I'm not opposed to lifting up protein pretty high, actually. And in fact, I was having a conversation with Jose Antonio. Like, he's, you know, he's done a number of great studies, and like his wife is an endurance athlete. And she's on like 3 grams per kg body weight. And I'm like, awesome.
It's carnivore. Amazing.
Yeah. And it's so good from a micronutrient, from a brain, from a hormone, from a recovery and blood sugar stabilization sort of perspective. And I am, and I'm sure you are as well, a fan of strength training for bones. So that's important.
I've been following your Instagram, how you've been working on your upper body strength and chin-ups.
Yes.
Holy cow, that's amazing.
And you know, what this showed me, like a year ago, I could not do one chin-up, couldn't do one. And I was in the gym like 3 times a week doing weights. And I'm like, if I can't functionally move my body, what's the point? And it actually just came down to consistency with them. Anyone can do them. It's just actually being consistent day to day with practicing. It's just one thing I'm really proud of. It's just the chin-up that I can do. Yeah.
You should be. That's no joke.
Yeah. Incredible. Hey, Mickey, we're mindful of your time. We know you've got to move to your next interview after. Why don't you have the last 5 minutes? Tell us what you're doing right now and where listeners can go and find out more about you and get your help.
Thank you, Paul. So currently I'm wrapping up some group programs. I work primarily in that perimenopause sort of fat loss space, albeit as an endurance athlete myself. I do attract a lot of women like me, if you like, and guys as well. I have some, this is my personal goals for 26. I'm doing hopefully doing Gold Coast Marathon and Chicago Marathon. And the thing is that I really just want to enjoy them. I'm not like, I'd love to do well, but equally with Chicago, I literally just want to jog it. Like, I just want to do, I'm ticking off the majors. I have a couple of longer run, plans, but at the minute I'm struggling with a hamstring tendinopathy, which is really sort of doing like, which is a bit of a challenge. So I've had to almost pull pin on an 80K run in February with the mind of wanting to do Gold Coast Marathon. Like, I've really got to think, okay, what is my primary sort of goals here? But I'm just here in New Zealand. I've got my podcast, Micopedia, where people can sort of get more insights both from me on my mini episodes and from guests that I have had on the show, such as Dr. Paul Lawson, of course, and Phil Maffetone, Dan Plews, like all of probably the favorites of the listeners of your show. And I'm pretty active on social under at Mickey Willardin. So I love to just share things on there, like my chin-up challenge.
Yeah, I love your mini Mickey episodes. They are awesome, like 20, 25 minutes deep dive into a topic. And knowing you, jogging a marathon is still pretty fast.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Thank you, MJ.
Yeah, if you've not checked out Micopedia yet, that is definitely a podcast to listen to. It is one of my regulars that I listen to on the bike, and it's outstanding.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, Mickey, thank you so much for joining us again to try to unravel this complicated topic, and we appreciate your presence.
Thank you so much. And I just knew coming on, it would just be a great opportunity to bring up some of the things that we think about when we're considering constrained energy expenditure model or calories in, calories out, you know, like practically speaking, what are the challenges and what are the opportunities to improve our understanding of it and how can we help, you know, the people that we coach. So thanks so much for the opportunity, guys.
Thanks so much, Mickey.
Thanks for listening today to the Athlete's Compass podcast. Take a moment now, subscribe, share, and let's keep navigating this endurance adventure together. Improve your training with the science-based training platform Athletica and join the conversation at the Athletica Forum. For Dr. Mickey Willardin, Mariana Rakai, and Dr. Paul Larson, I'm Paul Warlowski, and this has been the Athlete's Compass Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed another episode of the Athlete's Compass Podcast, your North Star through the sometimes complicated world of training for your endurance sport. We appreciate your comments and training questions and your 5-star reviews. For a deeper dive into the science of endurance sports, listen to the Training Science Podcast and check out the adaptive AI training platform athletica.ai. Thanks for listening.